You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot in the news today, and we'll, you know, Bernie was with us yesterday, so we'll just do Anything Goes Friday, all 3 hours. If you have anything on your mind that you want to talk about, any topics we've covered throughout the week, topics that we haven't covered, things that we should be talking about in your opinion, or that you want to talk about, give us a call, and we will get into it. This Israel versus Hamas thing is really, it's really heating up. And I think this is actually, I almost said this is starting. I think this has hurt Israel. I mean, obviously, killing 100 people in the Gaza Strip, 100 Palestinians, including children, is hurting them, too. And this is, you know, that's a terrible thing. And I think that Israel's just gone off the. I think they've gone around the bend on this. They are giving in to the most radical right wing faction within their country. And all of this got started because in all probability, it appears some real radical right wingers beat and killed and burned alive this Palestinian kid. And this is very concerning. And what's even more concerning is that, you know, nobody in Congress is talking about this. Everybody's afraid to take on this topic and in Congress. And it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be. GMOs, genetically modified organisms. GMO is an abbreviation for genetically modified organisms. And you'll recall back in September of 2012, almost 2 years ago, a study was published in one of the peer-reviewed journals. It was published in Food and Chemical Toxicology, which is a peer-reviewed journal. You have to pass peer review. In other words, you have to prove to scientists of equal or superior academic credentials to you that the research that you did and the conclusions that you drew are legitimate. And it was published. And what it said was that rats who ate Monsanto's genetically modified corn that has been specifically genetically modified to be relatively immune to glyphosate, however you say it, Roundup. That people who ate this, that rats who ate this corn suffered liver and kidney disease and tumors. This is serious stuff. Well, there was this huge, I mean, Monsanto just unleashed this in September 13th, this major campaign to trash these scientists and their research. It got so bad that the original journal, Food and Chemical Toxicology, a year later, pulled the article and said, okay, we're unpublishing this article. Not because anybody had proved to them that it was false, but because it was just like this sustained barrage. Now they've republished it 2 years later, along in a new journal. This is the Environmental Sciences Europe, another peer-reviewed journal. They've redone the research. They found that their original findings were not only robust but repeatable. And they're talking about the PR and disinformation campaign that was launched against them in the new piece, in the new article. We're guinea pigs. Meanwhile, the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, the Food Safety Division, they're with chickens now, I guess this is, they're outsourcing to the companies themselves, the inspection of their food. We have the highest rate of any developed country in the world of foodborne illness here in the United States. Because for 34 years, ever since Reagan came into office, basically, the idea that government is the problem, not the solution, we have been steadily cutting the budgets and diminishing the powers of the food protection folks in our government who were put into place as a result of, I think it was Sinclair Lewis, wasn't it, who wrote The Jungle back in 19-something? Say what? Oh, it was Upton Sinclair. Yeah, I always mix up my Sinclairs. It's Upton Sinclair. He wrote The Jungle. It was about meatpacking plants and how filthy they were and how deadly the food was. And it was like back in the 19-teens or the 1920s, something like that. We've always had this idea that, you know, food is part of our commons. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. How can you have life if you don't eat? By the way, Ramadan Mubarak to our Muslim friends. May you have a blessed Ramadan. I only recently, you know, I'm slowly learning things about various world religions, and I thought that when you fasted during Ramadan from sunrise to sunset, that you could drink water, because whenever I've fasted, I drank water. In fact, I drank a lot of water. The conventional wisdom for health fasting is drink a lot of water, right? Detoxify. But observant Muslims don't even drink. I mean, it's literally a fast. No food, no water from sunrise to sunset. I find that just an absolutely remarkable statement of commitment to one's faith. And it's those kind of really strong commitments that bind people to each other and to their commitment to their faith. I have so much respect for that. But back to the food. We are guinea pigs here in the United States in this giant food experiment. I mean, we've just become guinea pigs. You, me, everybody. Some 70, 80, 90% of our corn now is this kind of genetically modified stuff or variations on it. You know, basically, unless you buy something that says organic on it or non-GMO, odds are extremely high. You know, particularly if you eat in restaurants or fast food joints, or you're just buying chips from the 7-Eleven or whatever, that it's made with genetically modified corn. It's massive in the United States, and it could be caught. You know, if the study is right, and if what happens to rats happens to humans, which typically is the case, mammals are mammals. I mean, I've seen statistics on the rise not only of obesity, but the rise of kidney disease in the United States. And people are assuming that somehow it has something to do with whatever's causing the rise of obesity, and there's all these different debates on that. You know, is it gut flora? Is it high fructose corn syrup? Is it people watching computers and TV? Do we need to go back to John Kennedy's having kids working out in schools? Does it start in childhood? Is there a virus involved? I mean, all of these things are possibilities. And there's been an assumption that the liver failures that seem to be associated with that somehow have something to do. Maybe not. Maybe it's GMO food. I think we are suffering in the United States from malnutrition. Now, malnutrition doesn't mean you don't have enough food. It means you have bad food. Mal is the Latin word for bad. Malnutrition means bad nutrition. We are eating things that are killing us. On the way in this morning, I stopped at Union Station, and there's a guy out there. He was selling blueberries and cherries, and I bought some blueberries and cherries. I'd be willing to bet, given how perfect they are, that they're laced with pesticides and herbicides. God only knows what. In fact, they probably came from some other country. Depends on the time of year. Actually, this time of year, they probably came from the United States, but whatever. It's like, unless you're going to go to Whole Foods, and then they're selling Eden Foods, who wants to deny their female employees birth control. It gets weird. It gets weird.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So anyhow, that's my rant for the day. I got a few other news stories here. We'll get into them. We got 3 hours to do it. We'll pick up your calls right after the break. It's Anything Goes Friday. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Bill. In Prescott, Arizona, watching us on Free Speech TV's website, freespeech.org. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. You know, big World War II buff, mm-hmm. And I could never understand how the Germans did not know what was going on.
What was going on where, when?
With the concentration camps and stuff, I'm sorry.
Oh, you mean average Germans?
Yeah, average Germans during World War II.
Right. I think that, I lived in Germany for a year back in the 80s, and back in the 80s, there were still elderly Germans around who were Nazis. I knew a couple who were Nazis. I knew one who was an unrepentant Nazi. I knew all the rest of them that I knew were you know, horrified Nazis. And a few people who were just, you know, quote, average people during that time. And basically the story that I heard, and I think that if you read They Thought They Were Free, forgetting the author, I used to read from this book on the air. It'll come to me when I'm not trying to remember it, but the book is They Thought They Were Free. It was published back in the 60s by a Chicago journalist who went over to Germany after World War II in the 1950s and spent a lot of time, I don't know if he lived with, but he spent an enormous amount of time with 10, quote, average Germans, from a college professor to a factory worker, and got their stories about what happened, and then he wrote this book, They Thought They Were Free. And
Tom?
Yes.
Yeah, just one thing. Excellent information. My follow-up, what I wanted to say was, with the media the way it is and how they've dumbed down the country, and really most of the country really doesn't know what's going on, that makes me understand how they got away with it, and the Germans didn't know.
Well, and that was the thing. I think a lot of average Germans, they knew that Jews were being rounded up. They knew that Jews were being taken off someplace. They didn't realize they were to death camps. They thought they were to prisons, basically. And you know, we did the same thing with the Japanese during World War II, although we didn't put them in death camps. I mean, we didn't do the same thing, but we rounded up Japanese from all over the West Coast and shipped them up to concentration camps. And average Americans said, okay, that's cool. And, you know, had our government gone totally psychotic and decided to exterminate those people and basically do it outside the country, which is, you know, Germany, Hitler also did that. He put the death camps in Poland and in Holland, and, you know, he put them outside Germany so that the German, partly so he'd have plausible deniability. I think this is sort of the modern variation on this is George W. Bush rendering, people to Egypt and to Turkey and to places where they could be tortured. And, hey, everybody gets tortured here, you know, so, you know, it's nothing out of the ordinary, rather than bringing them here. But I think that also there were some Germans who did know, and there was a real attempt to tell people. There was this group called the White Rose Society that was a student group, and WhiteRoseSociety.org kind of, you know, carries on. They stream progressive talk radio, but, you know, in the honor of these young people, they were executed by Hitler, these college students who created the White Rose Society in Germany. And they had a pretty good idea what was going on, and they were trying to tell people, which is why Hitler executed them. So, anyway, this is, we got a lot of calls on a lot of issues here. Trade policy, national emergencies, GMOs, Israel, mergers, Florida redistricting, immigration, and a poem. We'll be back with your calls, right? Back, Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. James in Wilmington, Delaware. Hey, James, you want to talk about trade policy?
Yes, sir. Tom, how are you doing today?
I am very well, thank you. What's up?
It looks like the people in the Obama trade part of the government are taking a page out of Frank Luntz's playbook. They're ready to reclassify corporations and offshore U.S. jobs as factory-less goods manufacturers. So, in other words, they're a manufacturer that doesn't really have a factory. And then, on the other hand, they're going to say that Foxconn in China isn't an offshore company. It's a manufacturing service provider. So, if Apple, if Foxconn ships a phone from China to Germany for sale, it's going to be counted as a manufactured U.S. manufactured export to Germany. So all they're trying to do is shift the numbers around, so it's going to deflate the manufacturing trade deficit while pretending that we're increasing U.S. manufacturing jobs.
That's bizarre. James, we need so much more transparency and so much clarification in our trade laws. It's crazy. Foxconn is not a U.S.-owned company. It's a Chinese-owned company,
no.
Isn't it? And I mean, this was the business model that made Phil Knight a billionaire, was Nike. He said, you know, I'll own the brand here in the United States, but I'm not going to make a single shoe. And we'll find companies in the lowest labor, lowest regulation countries we can find where we get the cheapest, where we can get, you know, decent quality, but at the cheapest price made. And we'll make the shoes there and we'll bring them to the United States. And he manufactures all over the world. And, I understand. And, you know, hey, you're doing it. It's within the law. You know, God bless you, but it shouldn't be within the law. We need to change our trade policy so that if a pair of shoes made in the United States has a dollar's worth of labor in them and you make them in the Philippines and there's only 10 cents worth of labor in them, there's a 90-cent tax when they hit our borders. And, it's straightforward stuff. James, thanks for the call. Jim in Lake Forest, Illinois. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I want to propose an idea. I respect you. Probably could tell me why this can't work. I really don't know. I'm going over and over it. And what I want to do is, excuse me, I would like President Obama to go in front of the public, first off, declare a national emergency under the guise that our unemployment levels are not high, and our unemployment levels are not high enough. We have not extended minimum wage, or not rather put in a minimum wage or extended higher, et cetera, go down a lack of infrastructure on down the line. And then, following that, first point out the progress we've made in each of these areas. You know, we've taken unemployment from, 9% to 6, whatever it is now, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And we have proposed bills and mentioned specific bills proposed. You know, the jobs bill, the jobs for infrastructure, you know, the infrastructure measures and so forth, and tie that to the fact that all those things, including raising the minimum wage, would provide more jobs and higher wages for the average person out there.
Yeah.
You can go into the reason if you want for that. And at the end of that, say the reason that we can know what we have not made more progress. And I apologize, this is Obama. I apologize. I feel bad about it. We've tried and we tried and we tried, but we've been obstructed. And it takes two to tango in Congress. So I'm going to ask. I know we can't demand it, but he said I'm going to ask Congress not to go on recess for this summer and possibly through the end of the year. Now I know they won't do that. Okay.
Yeah, I mean they're about to go on another 5-week vacation. At the end of the month.
It's canceled.
You know.
Tell the Democrats in advance to be ready. Clear off their calendars.
Yeah.
And I expect people to stay here and get their jobs. I'll be here. You'll be here.
Right.
And that, to
we're all going to be working. The president will be working. Congress won't. The declaring a national emergency, I don't know all the powers that come with that, and I'm guessing that there are very specific laws and there are very specific types of national emergencies that could be declared. But right now, I mean, John Boehner is basically going to try and sue him for being king. And that would throw it into impeachment overnight. But I think he's starting to get it. He's starting to message this stuff. Members of Congress are starting to get it. Bernie talked about it on this program yesterday. Jim, thank you for the call. That the caucus room conspiracy is alive and well. That these guys met the night that Obama was being sworn into office and swore an oath to each other to obstruct everything. As Kevin McCarthy said, we're gonna block every single bill, and they've done it. And the result is that 3 million people have lost their unemployment insurance. You've got, you know, families are breaking up. People are becoming homeless. You know, one of the good things about the unemployment numbers, I just want to mention this very quickly. Unemployment is down to 6.1 or 6.2%, which is, you know, theoretically quite good. And one of the good things about this low unemployment number is that there's about apparently 800,000 people who have moved from full-time jobs to part-time jobs, which has opened up those full-time jobs for other people, thus lowering the unemployment rate. And they've done it because of Obamacare. These are people who are in dead-end, I-hate-this-jobs, in jobs that they absolutely hated, they didn't want to be doing, they didn't want to have anything to do with. And they said, but they were staying there because they needed the health insurance, particularly if they had kids or if they had a spouse or whatever, they needed the health insurance. And so they kept the full-time jobs. Well, when Obamacare came along, they didn't need the full-time job anymore to get the health insurance. They could get the health insurance, particularly the mostly low-income people. But a lot of these were people in their 50s and 60s who were, you know, they were ready to work half-time, part-time. But they really needed the health insurance. They weren't old enough to qualify for Medicare. or they were, you know, people just coming into the job market, young people. They needed the health insurance, or people just, you know, working on poverty wages who had a family. Now with Obamacare, they're able to say, okay, you know, I've got two kids who come home from school every day at 3 o'clock. I really don't want to work from 9 until 6. I want to work from 9 until 3. And now they can. This is a good thing. So part of the drop in the unemployment rate is actually the result of Obamacare. And the Republicans are running around going, oh, my God, 800,000 people left the full-time workforce. Yeah, it's a great thing. They can now be home with their kids. I thought that was a Republican value. Anyhow, we'll be back with more of your calls on Anything Goes Friday.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's Anything Goes Friday, and at TomHartman.com you can drop into our live chat room as well. We'll be back with your calls. Very, very supalectically ugly, the good. Reverend Gary Hall, the Dean of Washington National Cathedral, is one of 100 faith leaders who on Tuesday sent a letter to President Obama asking him not to include a religious exemption in an upcoming executive order that would ban federal contractors from discriminating against LGBT Americans. Conservative groups have requested such an exemption in the wake of the Supreme Court's Hobby Lobby decision, saying it was necessary to preserve their religious freedom to discriminate against gay people. All the other 99 faith leaders opposed to a religious exemption disagree, pointing out that equal opportunity is a fundamental part of American democracy. They said, in a nation as diverse as the United States of America, it is critical that the federal government be trusted to follow, and indeed to role model, equitable employment practices. We believe that our mutual commitment to the common good is best served by policies that prohibit discrimination based on factors that have no relationship whatsoever to job performance. We are better and stronger as a nation when hiring decisions are made based on professional merit rather than personal identity. I couldn't agree more. Let's hope President Obama is listening. The bad. Brandon Smith. During a hearing last week on the EPA's new carbon emission rules, the Republican Kentucky state senator lashed out at an EPA official, essentially saying that climate change is a myth because Earth and Mars are the same temperature. Seriously, take a look.
I don't want to get into the debate about the climate change, but I will just simply point out that I think in academia we all agree that the temperature on Mars is exactly as it is here. Nobody will dispute that, yet there are no coal mines on Mars. There's no factories on Mars that I'm aware of.
Of all the stupid things Republicans say about climate change, that has got to be one of the weirdest. I mean, did this guy miss fourth grade science class? According to NASA, the average temperature on Earth is 57 degrees Fahrenheit. On Mars, it's minus 81 degrees Fahrenheit. So I'm not really sure what Brandon Smith was trying to get at here. But then again, when you're talking about Republicans and science, reality isn't usually part of the equation. And the very, very ugly, the Manassas City Police. The Virginia Law Enforcement Agency is under fire for trying to take a photo of a 17-year-old's erect penis and using an injection into it to make it that way. No, I'm not kidding. They actually tried to do this. Check it out.
Attorney Jessica Foster says her 17-year-old male client from Manassas is getting the raw deal from the justice system.
I don't understand why this is being pursued like this.
The teen defending himself on child pornography charges after the parents of a 15-year-old girl he was dating say he was sexting adult content of his body. The case has been in the courts for months but since thrown out on a technicality. But now the Prince William County Court is pressing new charges along with a warrant, forcing law enforcement to take a pic of the teen's erect penis to match it with his video. And if the boy is not aroused, doctors would be forced to inject stimulant medication into the teen's system.
Yeah. In the face of national publicity and ridicule, the Manassas cops have backed down. But just the fact that they thought this was a good idea and would have actually done it if it hadn't gone viral, that is very, very ugly. Welcome back. Let me get over to my call screening software here. There we go. John in Monson, Massachusetts. Hey, John, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I don't know if you've ever had a show on mergers and acquisitions, but in my opinion, you know, that's really hurting the country. I mean, the bigger the corporations get, the more they can push the countries around. You know, the airline merger of, and I don't remember which two airlines, that went through, and then you've got the Comcast merger that's in the works, with Time Warner. I mean, we're having less choices, and someone's got to stop it. I mean, we have to stop things. The mergers themselves just allow the corporations to be stronger and stronger. And I don't understand why no one's doing anything about it.
Here's the history of this, John. Back in the 1880s, John Rockefeller and the railroads and the steel companies were doing what you described. They were getting so large that they could dominate particular industries, whether it was the match industry was one that Teddy Roosevelt ultimately broke up. Sugar industry, he broke up. The steel industry, the banking industry, the railroads. And so in 1881 or 82, Senator Sherman of Ohio introduced into the United States Senate the Sherman Antitrust Act. And what this did was made it a crime punishable by prison time. Prison time for the executives of companies. As I recall, it was either 2 years or 5 years in jail. For creating a company that was large enough or a trust that was large enough that it would inhibit competition in the marketplace. And that was used by Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft in the 19-aughts and the 19-teens to break up lots and lots of companies. And it had been used throughout our history to keep companies from getting really large. And, in fact, the most recent time that it was really significantly used was when Richard Nixon initiated the breakup of AT&T, which was completed during the presidency of Jimmy Carter, into seven separate companies, which actually increased shareholder value and gave a big boost to the telecommunications business. But here's what happened. In 82 or 83, Ronald Reagan, on the advice of his corporate overlords and donors, basically said to his Justice Department, stop enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act. Just let them get as big as they want. It's, you know, government should not be messing in business. It's not a good thing. Government is not the first, you know, the solution to our problems. It's the cause of our problems. No more government interference in business. And we had this era, and if you're old enough to remember the early 80s, you had people like Michael Milken and you know, all these guys, they called themselves M&A artists, mergers and acquisition artists. There were a whole bunch of different phrases to describe what they were doing. The chainsaw Al Dunlop was famous for going into Sunbeam. I think he fired 10,000 people. We went from literally, and if you're not old enough to remember this, ask anybody who is. Before 1980, before the Reagan election, every town in America had its own unique character because they had all these local small businesses. And now you could jump out of an airplane at 50,000 feet and land anywhere in the United States and have no idea where you are, because everywhere you look, it's the same Olive Garden, the same McDonald's, the same Holiday Inn, the same Marriott, the same Macy's. Every mall is identical no matter where it is. We have completely homogenized the United States. We've been taken over now by a handful of very, very large corporations that operate under a couple of hundred brands, but which gives us the appearance of choice, but it's really just a small handful of companies. The same with our cable systems. You know, most of what people watch on cable, most of the content on cable, and even a lot of the different brands are owned by a small number of companies. And this all goes back to Ronald Reagan, and no president since Reagan has started enforcing the Sherman Act, and they still have the power to do it. Obama has the power to do this. He would have to order his Justice Department to do it. It's extremely unlikely, though, that anybody's going to take these guys on. They've got so much power. So, John, are you old enough to remember America before Reagan?
Yeah, but I have not been paying attention to politics up until the last few years. And yeah. I'm trying to make up for
But, I mean, you don't have to pay attention to the politics of it. Just remember, you know, I remember back in the late 50s, early 60s, there was a TV show called Route 66. Marty Milner and his sidekick, I'm forgetting the guy's name, George Maharis, I think. They literally drove, you know, this was before the Eisenhower Interstate Highway System or as it was being built. And so they drove this car from L.A. to New York, as I recall, on Route 66, which was the transcontinental highway. And it goes right through the middle of all these little towns. And every week they would stop in a town. They would get a job, because anybody could get a job back then. And every town had its own unique character. The local restaurants were locally owned. The local hotel was locally owned. The bank was locally owned. And you got a glimpse of all these different cities all across the United States. You can see the reruns. They're black and white. You know, over, I think Netflix has them. This is how America used to be. And it's been utterly destroyed by Reagan stopping the enforcement of the Sherman Act. And we need to reinforce it. John, thanks for the call. Shirley in Chicago. Hey, Shirley, what's up?
Hi. Listen to you every day, first time caller, because I agree with you 100% of the time. But your opening remarks on the Israel situation really disturbed me, because I felt that you were kind of saying that Israel should stop and that Congress should get in there. I think Israel is retaliating. I think Israel would lay down its arms if Hamas wouldn't wipe it off the earth, if given the opportunity.
But see, here's the thing. Hamas has no opportunity. There's not been a single Israeli killed outside of this tit for tat that started inside Israel.
Here's the thing.
In Gaza,
Israel has captured the perpetrator of the people who killed the Palestinian youth.
Right.
Palestine, if they found the people who killed the three Israeli teenagers, would name a square after them.
You don't know that.
Oh, well, yeah, I think so. It happens all the time. They become martyrs and they become heroes.
I don't think so.
And,
I really don't think so. This is
blame that I feel where I you're so right on all the time. I'm feeling that you're putting a lot on Israel when it's
I am not saying that Israel should not respond when rocket attacks come in. I'm not saying that at all. But they've killed over 100 people. Those rocket attacks coming out of Gaza, these are people living basically in a prison camp. And they're like throwing softballs. They haven't hurt anybody. And I mean, this is not to say they're blameless, but they haven't killed any Israeli. But Israel's killed 100 people in Gaza. They should stop already. That's what I'm saying. Shirley, thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And I say that, I've been to Israel a lot. I've spent probably a half a year in aggregate in Israel. I know the area really, really well, and I'm a supporter of Israel. I say that because I think this is harming Israel. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And George, watching Free Speech TV in St. Mary's, Georgia. Hey, George, what's on your mind today?
Tom, thanks for taking my call. I have a question for you. I'd like an update on this. The President's American Jobs Act, and call out the economic terrorists that refuse to invest in America.
Well, I wish I had that information at my fingertips. I don't, George. To the best of my knowledge, it has not passed either the House or the Senate. Do you know something different than that?
I do not. I just hadn't heard anything on it.
Yeah, I think it was filibustered in the Senate, and John Boehner would never bring it to the floor of the House.
Oh, it was filibustered. I didn't even know that.
I might be wrong. I mean, it's not inconceivable that the Senate even passed it, but I doubt it. To the best of my knowledge, the only two significant or consequential pieces of legislation that the Senate has passed with, you know, over the objections of Republicans, but they were able to get at least a couple of Republican votes to pass, have been the extension of long-term unemployment benefits, which would have extended them from December to May, and it is now July. That went to the House, and John Boehner, to this day, is refusing to hold a vote on it.
Right.
Excuse me. That's one. And then the second one is the comprehensive reform of our immigration policies, which would have, you know, I mean, they threw a lot of bones to the Republicans. It would have strengthened the border down in the South and added more border police and all this kind of stuff. And it passed with Republican support in the Senate. And John Boehner refuses to allow a vote on that in the House as well. So John Boehner is refusing to allow a vote in the House on these two big bills, and then pretending like the president isn't doing anything.
And when they say it's his own doing or whatever, why don't some of these reporters ask John Boehner to, you know, elaborate on that?
Yeah. Well, what he is, it appears that what he's going to do when he does his little lawsuit hissy fit here against Obama, and probably I shouldn't minimize it, because if the Republicans take the Senate in the election of 2014 because progressives don't show up and vote, And there's a very real possibility of that happening. If they take the Senate, I think that that lawsuit is going to become a bill of impeachment. And what they're saying is that, you know, we passed this law that says that employers are subject to the same mandate as individuals, you know, the employer mandate part. And frankly, you know, Louise and I were looking forward to that. We wanted to be able to buy health insurance on the exchanges for our employees as an employer, because right now we've, I mean, last year we saw our rates go up, I think, 20-some-odd percent, maybe as much as 30%. We you know, the insurance companies are really sticking it to employers right now, particularly small employers. And you know, we provide full health, 100% health insurance for our employees. And Obama said, you know, I'm going to put this off for a year. Arguably, only Congress can do that. But here's the thing. The Constitution says that the president shall faithfully execute the laws. Now, what does that mean? Nobody has ever clearly defined that. Does faithfully mean that he's going to do exactly what the law says? If so, he doesn't have the power to postpone the employer mandate for a year. On the other hand, if he does so, if faithfully means that he will execute the laws in a way that is consistent with the understanding of Congress, then, you know, you could make an argument that he has done the right thing. If on the third hand, faithfully means he will execute the laws in the way that makes them most effective and most successful, then he has certainly done his job. And so the question is whether this will get thrown to the court, to the Supreme Court. But Scalia came out yesterday or the day before and said, you know, we really don't want to get in the middle of a battle between the executive branch and the legislative branch. They need to work these things out themselves. So we'll see where this goes. George, thanks for the call. Welcome back. I'm Hartman here with you. And if anything goes, Friday. And by the way, over at America Blog, Gaius Publius has this great piece. House candidate Nancy Skinner makes climate a centerpiece issue in a winnable race. A Democratic House candidate is making climate a centerpiece issue. And so, okay, yeah. Nancy Skinner is actually on the line with us. SkinnerForCongress.com is her website. She's a candidate for the 11th District in Michigan, previously a syndicated radio and TV commentator. As I told you yesterday, when I started on iAmerica Radio, Nancy was there. That's when I met Nancy. That was a decade ago or thereabouts. And she is just a great person. Nancy, hey, welcome.
Hey, Tom. How weird is this?
It's wonderful. I think it's absolutely wonderful. You're running for Congress. Good on, again, good on you. And so tell us about the race, tell us about the district, and tell us about the primary.
Yeah, well, this is my third time running for, you know, Congress. The reason I actually got into media, Tom, I don't know that we ever had this conversation given how well we've known each other, is because of climate change. I read Earth in the Balance back in 1993. I actually have a business degree from U of M, and I read Earth in the Balance and decided to use my business degree as in a new field called sustainable development, because when business finally adopted these, you know, renewable energy technologies, then we could make some serious progress. So it was like on my website, SkinnerForCongress.com is my whole bio. You can read this whole saga. But basically, my first foray was I called the White House and said, hey, why don't we rebuild these flood towns after the Great Midwestern Floods in 1993 as models of environmental sustainability? And I got bounced around for a month or so, and they finally said, that's a great idea. Let's do it. So a mid-level guy at the Department of Energy, who is now the executive director of President Obama's climate action plan. And so we rebuilt these towns. I won a presidential award. We did for our work. It's featured in a book called Eco Pioneers. But the radio, Tom, there was Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and all this disinformation campaign going on about, you know, that it's a hoax, the American Petroleum Institute. You all know that they spent tons of money way back in the late, like, 89 forming these PR groups. So I got a radio show on WLS in Chicago and big station, and I was nationally syndicated, and, you know, it was just at the time you and Mike Malloy and just all of us were starting to hit the airwaves with the message. My first guest was Ross Gelbspan, who wrote the book The Heat Is On about the disinformation campaign, and I focused on climate change constantly for 8 years till I got talked into running for an open Senate seat in a wide-open primary, and there was a guy in the race who was pretty good, but everyone said he had zero chance of winning because of his name, and, of course, his name was Barack Obama.
Oops.
I lost to POTUS, but I ran on climate change 10 years ago in 2004. He ran on health care. He won. Yeah. Now, he's in his second term. I moved back to my home state of Michigan, your home state, our home state, and I was on the radio locally doing a progressive show, and then I ended up running in 2006 against Joe Nolenberg, a 14-year incumbent Republican. He had $4 million. No one thought I had a chance in hell, frankly. I came within a few points of beating him on climate change. Bobby Kennedy Jr. did my ads. The debate is over. The technology is here. All we need is the leadership. That's why we need to elect Nancy Skinner to Congress. That was 8 years ago, before the auto industry collapsed and gas prices went, you know, to $4 a gallon. So here I am, fast forward. I wasn't planning on running again. I was helping some women get elected and writing a book on messaging climate change so that we could have an electoral path to victory, a national messaging campaign. When taking the women out on the stumps to the local Dem groups I know here, and women's groups, they were like, why aren't you running in the 11th? We can win this seat. And so, you know, I made some calls, and, I was writing this paper saying, okay, I could write a book about climate change, another book, or I could run and show people that we can win and run, and finally we can. So this race is something else. I mean, you can't make this stuff up.
Yeah.
The incumbent is a first-term Tea Party guy named Kerry Bentivoglio. He was a reindeer farmer and a Santa Claus impersonator professionally. You know, like that's what he did. He raised his reindeer and he'd go down the chimney. But he's a major climate denier, and, you know, every other global conspiracy, but he likes the climate. And so he got in only because Thaddeus McCotter, his staff took 200 signatures and cut and pasted them into 2,000, and he had election fraud, and he had to resign early.
So wait a minute. The congressman who represents the district, the 11th District of Michigan, in which you are going, you're running now in the Democratic primary to run against, you know, this congressman, the guy is a Santa Claus impersonator? Who denies climate change?
That was his profession, yep. He was, you know, like not just the kind of stand at the mall once a year. He was a year-round. He had a reindeer farm, and he would put on shows and come down the chimney.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and then there's another guy on the Republican side, too, isn't there? Because I remember this Scrooge versus Santa thing.
Yeah, Mother Jones did an article. They called this 2014 strangest GOP primary, Santa versus Scrooge. So, of course, he's vulnerable, and so the GOP isn't going to let this seat go away. So they, in all their wisdom, decide to recruit Michigan's eviction and foreclosure king, who did 90% of the evictions in Michigan, but he's also one of the top few in the country who worked for Bank of America when they had to settle for $25 billion because all these servicing companies, we had robo-signers, you know, signing foreclosure documents.
So the guy's a lawyer?
About 2 months ago did an expose on David Trott. He bought all the verticals, all the companies in the foreclosure chain. So he was making money on the software processing. He bought the Detroit Legal News on each posting. And his notaries, they went into this. It's all online. You can't make this stuff up. And he had notaries signing foreclosure documents in comas and dead.
Wow.
So it starts at reprehensible business practices for David Trott. It ends at prison. I don't know. I don't know. It's bad. So Santa is beating Scrooge 33-21% in the polls here.
Uh-huh.
That's the Republican side.
Right.
Okay? This is a ripe seat.
We have a little less than a minute, Nancy.
Primary. I jumped in because they all wanted me to. We have two men who've never run for office. We have one LaRouche candidate. I was on a show with him, a local show, and he was, you know, railing on about first thing you do was to impeach the president. I had to slap him down. But there are two other men who've never run for office before, just decided this is a seat that they could win, a wealthy urologist and a CIA State Department guy for 5 months. For 5 months, he's over in the Middle East for all this time. Goes back to the State Department for 5 months. Comes back here last November, and he's running.
So it's going to be very interesting. So people can learn all about it. We're talking with Nancy Skinner. You can find out all about it at skinnerforcongress.com. That's S-K-I-S.
They can go on Flip a District, #FlipTheDistrict, and vote for Michigan's 11th.
Okay.
Contest, that would be fantastic.
Okay, great. Nancy Skinner, we'll be right back. Thank you, Nancy.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Anything Goes Friday. Dan in Macomb, Ohio. Hey, Dan, what's up? You want to talk about Florida redistricting?
Yes, sir. How are you today?
I'm great.
I'm a new resident to Ohio, and I moved here from Florida after living there for 10.5 years. And after reading the news report from the Associated Press about what's going on with that a circuit judge ruled that the Florida redistricting was deemed illegal, I'm wanting to know what your take on the matter is, especially given the two districts that are in question. One would be District 3 with Corinne Brown, and the other one, I believe, is District 8 with Daniel Webster. Being that I used to work for OFA in 2012, and actually working actively with these districts as well, I can tell you right now, where I used to live in Florida, our congressman was Bill Posey, and he actually, one time I met him, and he actually made the comment, because I asked him, I said, you know, what are the chances that the Democrats could take back the majority of the seats? And he said, not a chance in hell.
Right, because of redistricting.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. This is a plague all across our country, and it has been for 200 years. It's gotten worse in the age of computerization. They're now drawing districts where they're able to get demographic information and even voter information that's so granular that they can include individual houses, you know, or individual streets, you know, part of a street and not part of a street into a district to create safe Republican and safe Democratic districts. Both parties have done this. In 2010, the Republicans made a huge effort because every year that ends with zero, for people who don't know what we're talking about here, the Constitution says that every 10 years, every year that ends in a zero, so it's 10 times every century, the census will be taken. And then based on that census, the number of members of the House of Representatives has to be basically nationally consistent and representative. So every person in the House of Representatives represents roughly the same number of people. In the original Constitution, I think it was something like 300,000 or something. There was actually a number there, but they've you know, that's kind of been blown by. But the point is that as population grows in individual states or shrinks, those states have to increase or decrease the number of representatives, and thus they have to change the borders of the congressional districts. This is called redistricting. And that was the original intent, was simply to make sure that as states got larger or smaller relative to each other, that every member of Congress was always representing roughly the same number of people. So it was a body of equals, essentially. And the people were well represented, were equally represented. Now, where it got political was when the political parties emerged after the election of 1800, and the political parties started getting very, very partisan and started using the opportunity of redistricting to redraw the districts. And I think it was in the 1820s or 1830s, Mr. Jerry, thus gerrymandering, as in salamander, drew a congressional district, I believe it was in New Jersey, I could be wrong, that looked like a salamander, and so they called it gerrymandering. And what it was let's create a district where we know that the guys who will vote for me are all in this district, and the guys who won't vote for me are out of the district. They're in somebody else's district. And that's why we have a 96 or 97 or 98% incumbent reelection rate in the United States. This is really only 20 or 30 districts that are in play in the entire country. All the rest of them have been either, you know, have been redrawn in ways that are entirely Democratic or entirely Republican. So what this judge ruled in this Florida case was that in the 2010 redistricting in Florida, that, you know, you're supposed to redistrict to the good of the country, to the good of equal representation, not to the good of a political party. at least in Florida, and I believe it's a federal law, but I could be wrong on this. Say what, Shane? Yeah, okay, it's a Florida constitution. The Florida Constitution says that you have to consider the good of the state, not the good of your party, first. And what this judge ruled is that the Republican Party had coordinated with the legislature that was redrawing the districts in a way that was entirely partisan. And so he's saying these districts were illegally redrawn. But this is a national problem. There are some states where there's no law against it. There's other states where, you know, it's slightly regulated. California, I believe, how they determine who is doing the districts. They have a commission now that's a certain number of Democrats, a certain number of Republicans, a certain number of independents. And the result of that, the consequence of that has been that, you know, California's districts are more representative of the state than pretty much anywhere else in the country, I guess. But I think that we should pass a federal law or even an amendment to the Constitution that says that congressional districts have to be polygons. They have to be as close to a circle or a square as possible. And that, you know, given the geography of the state and what they abut, and that, you know, they're basically drawn by computer. I mean, we can do that now. And that there's no partisan intent whatsoever. And then you would have congressional elections where, you know, 20, 30, 40% of members of Congress would be flipping every 2 years because people would actually be voting for people based on their records rather than their party affiliation. Am I making sense, Dan?
Yes, sir. Okay. I will also tell you, I mean, when you look at, I'll give you Corinne Brown's district, for example. You know, you look at District 3, Corinne Brown covers pretty much everywhere from Jacksonville to Orlando, but it is one, it looks like a snake.
Yeah, and, yeah, or a worm.
And you can absolutely, absolutely. And you can tell, if they were to do it the way that you're stating, I guarantee you that they would, you know, the representation within, at least within the state of Florida, and I'm sure other states as well, as you said, would drastically change. And
yes.
Be a little more even.
It would, and you would see the House of Representatives, I mean, more than, In the last election, more than 500,000 people voted in favor of Democratic members of the House than voted for Republican members of the House. So nationwide, House of Representatives races, 500,000 more votes for Democrats than Republicans. So you would think that there would be more Democrats than Republicans in the House of Representatives, but there aren't, because Republicans were successful in particularly in the election of 2010, but also in 2000 in many states. They were successful in very strategic redistricting, and thus they have this institutional preference for Republicans. These districts that are always going to go Republican simply because of the way that they were drawn. And the other thing that they did is they also tried to push many of the Democratic districts, you know, abut them with black districts, so that more and more of the Democratic members of Congress were people of color, on the assumption that that would cause white Southern racists to think that if somebody is black, they must be a Democrat, or that the Democrats are the people who are always supportive of people who are people of color, and basically activate the racist base. And they have had some considerable success in doing that. And this whole thing, it's not good for America. It's, you know, it's good for the Republican Party, I guess, arguably, but it's not good for America. So, Dan, thanks for the call. Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon. Hey, Ed, what's up? We're operating under an emergency in some parts of the country, you say?
Well, a state of national emergency in the country. I think that after 9/11, George Bush declared a state of national emergency. We're still operating under it. And I think that maybe the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendment have been suspended because the way court cases go down and the way the president acts, just killing American citizens if he feels like it, and
there was no formal declaration.
I think it's a state secret. And the only people they've told is like the Supreme Court and some members of Congress, the ones who would keep from introducing laws that would make it less apparent, would not let it come out if the president should do something, then they go, well, we're going after the president. Well, you can't.
Well, that's
does,
essentially what John Yoo and Jay Bybee said when they advised President Bush that torture was okay. The 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th Amendments of the Constitution don't matter. And, and for that matter, the rules of war don't matter. The Uniform Code of Military Justice doesn't matter. None of that stuff matters because we're facing an existential threat. Interesting, Ed. Thanks a lot for the call. I don't think that there is a secret conspiracy at the federal level to have us under a state of emergency. But I do think we have an emergency. It's billionaires running our country.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I mean, this is just not a good thing. We have moved from being a democratic republic to being a constitutionally monarchical oligarchy. It's not a healthy thing. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Ellen, watching Free Speech TV in Quartzsite, Arizona. Hey, Ellen, you have a poem?
Yes, I do. It's called Victim of Democracy.
Okay. We generally ask people not to read on the air, but Danielle tells me it's short. And so it's Anything Goes Friday, so go for it.
America, our home of peace and opportunity. Someone broke the promise my fathers made to me. What can we dream to be when we have been deceived and bound in chains of poverty, while rich men pay no taxes, pollute the land and sea, and drive men they call brothers into lives of slavery? They tell us that we have no choice, that no one listens to our voice. But if good men take the time to vote, our votes can make us free. Where there's a lesser of two evils, not choosing is a sin. The one thing I can say for sure about this mess we're in is when the good guys never vote, the bad guys always win. So here's the burning question in the land of liberty. Will you be a voter, or will you be just another victim of democracy? Thank you.
Wow. Brilliant. Ellen, thank you very much for the call, and thanks for the poem. That was brilliant. Michael in Antioch, California. Hey, Michael, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm one of those guys, one of those people that has been watching you and or listening to you for 10 years. You refer to us on occasion, so
well, thank
I'm calling again. Yeah, great show. I have a question about the potential presidential run by Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that you voted for... Ralph, I'm walking, that's why I'm out of breath.
All right.
I remember you voted for Ralph Nader either in 2000 or 2004, and you regretted it.
It was 2000, and I didn't regret it.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I lived in Vermont. If I had lived in Florida, I would not have voted for Ralph Nader, and I would not have regretted it. But because we lived in Vermont and we knew it was going to go for Al Gore, Louise and I actually split our vote because as a family, we wanted to make a statement that we supported the Democratic candidate who we felt had a real chance to win. And in fact, I believe did win that election. I agree with Jimmy Carter on that. And but I also wanted the Green Party, which Ralph Nader was their candidate. I wanted them to get that. I think it was a 5% vote threshold that they had to get in Vermont to qualify for state matching funds. And you know, so I wanted to make a statement. So we split our vote. Louise voted for Al Gore. I voted for Ralph Nader. And I've told Ralph that on the air. When Ralph ran in 2004, I had Ralph on the air, and I said, Ralph, this is a mistake. You shouldn't be doing this. And or at least do it strategically. Do it in ask people who live in swing states not to vote for you, to vote, but instead to vote for John Kerry. And Ralph would not do that. And Ralph and I got in a fight on the air about that. But that's the history of that.
Well, the question I have is, I don't think Senator Sanders is going to find someone progressive enough to be running. That's just my opinion. I've heard Hillary Clinton.
How about Sanders Warren?
Pardon me?
How about Sanders Warren?
Sanders
Warren. Well, Elizabeth Warren.
Oh, that'd be great.
That's a ticket for
you. If he decides to break with the Democrat, he's already not a Democrat, but if he decides to run as an independent, would you be in a conundrum?
I'd have to see what the lay of the land is. It's not a hypothetical that I can do, Michael, but I do support Bernie's candidacy for president. I think it's a marvelous thing that he's thinking of running. I would love to see him in the race, at least in a primary. Thank you, Michael, for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Sushi in our chat room says, I commented on a Twitter pic that said, of course money is speech. It says, I own you, to which I replied, well, if they own you, you become property. Money is property. You can't steal speech, but you can steal money, which is a brilliant observation. She says, if you rent money, it's called a mortgage or a loan. If you rent a person, it's called prostitution. If money is speech, is prostitution a conversation? If you throw out wads of dollars in the highway and there's an ensuing pileup, that's just exercising free speech, really? Bad words are suppressed, therefore speech is suppressed. It seems there's no such thing as bad money suppression. Really good point. She says the possibilities are endless, money is finite. Yes. Yes, 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 yes. Robert in Naples, Florida. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thank you. You know, this tragedy that's happening on the southern border with the United States with these children there.
Yeah.
I'm looking at our neighbors to the north, Canada, and I would imagine that, you know, they have some kind of agreement like we do with people of Central America, with NAFTA. There's some kind of trade agreements that we have with these people. How is it that Canada hasn't stepped up to the plate that's saying, hey, you know what, there's a tragedy in America. It's all part of North America. You know what, we're trying to push an oil pipeline in here. You know, maybe we should show good faith and you know, and say, well, we'll take every fifth bus, or maybe we'll help pay for this somehow, some way. I mean, it's very disappointing. You know, Canada being a very progressive place, you would think that they would be more than happy to help.
Sure. Canada's not all that progressive anymore. You have a conservative government in charge up there that's basically a Nixon kind of Republican government. Yeah, they've got national health care, but they also are pushing for the Keystone XL pipeline like crazy. You have a very pro-oil, pro-development. The president originally came from Calgary, if my memory serves me right, or at least from that state, from that province. And Alberta. And so, you know, A, there's that. B, I don't think that Canada would do it anyway, because it would basically be saying to the people in Central America, keep sending your kids. We'll do, you know, we'll help out. And this is a real delicate problem, because for every child, for every 100 kids who shows up on our border, there's probably, a half a dozen who died on the way, or who got child trafficked into a prostitution ring somewhere in Mexico, or, horrible things happened to them. I mean, we have no idea how bad the dimensions of this are. But, you know, when a train derails and there's 1,000 kids hanging on the outside of it in Mexico, you know, it's these kids, they're taking their lives in their hands to get here. So there's that. And third, NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, only covers North America. So it's Mexico, the United States, and Canada. These kids are coming from Central America. Now, we have a separate agreement with Central America. It's called CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement. And I believe it includes these countries, El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Honduras. But trade agreements don't say anything, to the best of my knowledge, about immigrants, or about refugees. I think that what we need to do, what Congress needs to do, is to declare this a refugee crisis. These children are refugees. They're not immigrants. They're not trying to. They're not coming here because they want to, you know, rake your yard or go to work in building houses or something. They're coming here because they are facing death. There are death squads. There are gangs. There's, you know, the murder rate in El Salvador right now is higher than Iraq. You are more likely to be killed in El Salvador as a child than you are in Iraq. It's one of the deadliest places on earth right now. So they're fleeing that. We need to identify them as refugees and deal with them as refugees rather than as immigrants. This is not an immigration problem. And these by and large, white right-wingers who are, you know, shouting at buses and screaming about kids are just, they make America seem so ugly. And the Republican Party seems so ugly. And Fox News pushing this meme, it's so ugly. This is just wrong. Robert, thank you for the call. Morris in Long Beach, California, listening. Morris just dropped off the phone. Oneida in Montclair, New Jersey, or is it Oneida?
It's Oneida, and it's in Sanford, Maine.
Oh, okay. And, sorry, Oneida.
I have a burning question that I had wanted to ask you for 10 years.
Okay.
Well, that lady that called in about the emergency, state of emergency, Bush declared a state of emergency right after 2/11. And then he established the Patriot Act, which is only can be enacted. It can only be used in a state of emergency. And we have been in a state of emergency ever since. It's never stopped, because if it stopped, we couldn't use the Patriot Act. But my question to you is, if it takes an amendment to change the Constitution in any form, and there's never been an amendment to take away our freedoms, the constitutional civil rights, and things like posse comitatus and habeas corpus, if there's never been an amendment passed, where is the Patriot Act legal?
Right.
That's my question.
That's a very good question. Shane, I'm not familiar with any part of the Constitution that provides for emergency, for suspension of constitutional rights during an emergency. You're a law school graduate, are you? Commander-in-Chief during time of war, yeah, but see, that's, I mean, you know, Abraham Lincoln suspended habeas corpus, declared a national emergency, but we were in a civil war. I mean, that's a very different thing. I don't know, Onita. I don't think that the Patriot Act is legal, and I don't think that a lot of the things that were done during the Bush administration, some of the things that are being done by the Obama administration, are constitutional. And I would like to see us reboot what we did back in the 70s with Senator Frank Church, the Church Commission, where members of, and you've got some good members of Congress who would do this, what's Ron's last name out of Oregon? Right? We're on Wyden. That's right. Ron Wyden and Pat Leahy from Vermont. I mean, you've got some really good senators who Pat Leahy is the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. I mean, he'd be the perfect person to do it, to look into this and start dialing back the CIA and the NSA and the FBI and start, you know, determining the constitutionality of the Patriot Act. I'm with you. I didn't know that the Patriot Act specifies that we're in a state of national emergency, therefore. And I don't believe that that's the case, although I may well be wrong. It's been a number of years since we did a really good, thorough show with a Patriot Act expert on, and we probably should do it soon. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
In fact, Shahid Batar, who was a guest on this program, what, yesterday? Day before yesterday? He's an expert on this kind of stuff. We should get him back on. We'll be back. So national emergencies. We did a little research during the break here, and it turns out that Section 202D of the National Emergencies Act, USC 50 USC United States Code 1622 subsection D, provides for the automatic termination of a national emergency. George W. Bush declared a national emergency right after 9/11. And here is a letter. It's on whitehouse.gov. It's dated September 10th of last year. It's a letter signed by President Obama to the Congress of the United States. Section 202D of the National Emergencies Act, 50 U.S.C. 1622D, provides for the automatic termination of a national emergency unless, within 90 days prior to the anniversary date of its declaration, the president publishes in the Federal Register and transmits to the Congress a notice stating that the emergency is to continue in effect beyond the anniversary date. Consistent with this provision, I have sent to the Federal Register the enclosed notice stating that the emergency declaration in Proclamation 7463 with respect to the terrorist attacks on the United States of September 11, 2001 is to continue in effect for an additional year. The terrorist threat that led to the declaration on September 14th, 2001 of a national emergency continues. For this reason, I have determined that it is necessary to continue in effect after September 14th, 2013, the national emergency with respect to the terrorist threat. Signed, Barack Obama. So, I don't know how I missed that. But, yeah, we are still in a state of national emergency, which gives the president extraordinary powers. And, wow. Scott in San Diego. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Let me come out of the kitchen. A quick thing before I get to my question. Earlier, you were talking about an incident in Manassas, Virginia, involving the police trying to pump chemicals or drugs into a kid's nether regions to cause an effect.
Yeah, there's a drug that they use for people who are impotent that you can inject it directly into the penis and it causes an instant erection. And at least that's my understanding.
There must be something in the water with police and people and focusing on that member of the anatomy. That was the place where 25 years ago the woman, Ms. Bobbitt, took a knife to her husband.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Anyway, that's just silliness.
I got to tell you a funny story, if I may, Scott. I was scheduled to be on CNN. It was in the 90s. I had written a book about ADD, and they were going to have me on to talk about that. I lived in Atlanta at the time, and I was going to go down to CNN headquarters. I went down the night before, or the afternoon before. We did this little rehearsal. I was going to be a guest on their morning show, and they had this morning show that was kind of like the Today Show kind of thing. And that morning, at 6 o'clock in the morning, that morning I got woken up to a phone call saying, don't come into the studio today. We're going to go live with the Bobbitt trial, the Lorena Bobbitt trial. And so we're cutting all of our guests that we had previously booked, and we're just going to do live coverage of the trial. And then the producer, she laughs, and she says, I guess you could say you're the second guy who's been cut by Lorena Bobbitt. So, bum-bum-bump. Okay, back to you, Scott.
Even then, CNN was covering the breaking important news, you know?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
All sensational all the time.
God. Anyway, a while back you did a topic of name one bill or one law that the Republicans put in that did everybody good as opposed to just big business and special interest. I have a twist on that. Let's say tomorrow morning something happened in the cosmos that caused all politicians to tell the absolute truth, to be incapable of misleading people or telling lies. How different would things be in the world or this country if tomorrow morning all the politicians had no other alternative but to tell the truth?
Well,
in other words, they would stop lying about things they lie about and start telling the truth about things, and then the other way around.
Yeah. I'm not sure things would change that much. I think that there are some people in Congress, and probably many members of Congress, with regard to individual issues where they do a song and dance based on the issue because, you know, their palms are being greased or because they know that they have to do that to either represent their district or represent wealthy interests in their district or even wealthy interests nationally. But I do think, I genuinely believe, and I base this on having grown up with a conservative Republican father, that the people who say that they believe that the country would be a better place if we all kind of deferred more readily to authority, if we had more respect for authority in this country, if the marketplace was freer, that a genuinely free and open marketplace could somehow be a better regulator of our country, or at least some dimensions of our country, than government bureaucrats, in quotes, or even elected officials. Even though there's not a lot of empirical evidence that supports those beliefs, and then you get into beliefs that my father didn't share, but that are shared by a lot of contemporary conservatives, that you know, a woman's place is in the kitchen, or that gay people shouldn't be part of society, or that people of color are inherently inferior, or something like that. Again, these are not positions that my father took, but they represent worldviews that are well represented in the Republican Party as not only wrong, but repugnant or repellent or disgusting, as many of those are, particularly the ones that assume racial superiority. The reality, Scott, is that there are a lot of people in this country who actually believe that. And so they would, if that was their political position, they would, even if you had, you know, magic fairy dust that could make them tell the truth, they'd still be saying the same thing.
Well, that's just the thing. I mean, those are beliefs. Those are opinions. Those are not reality.
My point.
There's a certain number of things that we can all agree on as being real if we're honest, and that's the key. People are politicians and their followers, some of them are just not being, you know, they wouldn't know the truth if it came and bit them.
Yeah. I mean, this is what happens, though, when we saw how toxic these kinds of particularly racial beliefs can be in both the eugenics movement in the United States in the 20s and then the Nazi movement in Germany in the 30s. But if we could somehow ban lying in politics, it would be anathema to the idea of free speech. But uh, I think that that's really the job of the press. That's why it's called the Fourth Estate. It's the fourth branch of government. It's the unofficial branch of government. The press is the only industry that's mentioned in the Constitution. It's the only one because it was so essential to be a check and balance on the other three branches of government. And the press has horribly failed to do that now. But I think that this should be the obligation of the media. Scott, thanks for the call. Thought provoking. Levan, am I saying that right? In Winoshka, Minnesota?
Levan.
Levan. Hey, Levan, what's up?
Okay, you were mentioning The Jungle, the book.
Yeah, Upton Sinclair.
Well, I graduated in 71 in Racine, Wisconsin, and we had to read that book. That was a required
Wow.
book. And it really is an eye-opener. And I'm a vegetarian now, so I'm sure that had something to help me.
Yeah.
But the question I want to ask is, you know, I keep hearing that the temperature has gone up 1 degree and it's going to cause such, you know, trouble. How do they come to that formula? Because I know it can't be the degrees. Like right now it's about 80 degrees and it can go 81. So could you share that?
Sure.
I'm hoping I'm not the only one that's...
No, there are two ways that they measure global temperatures. One is from outer space. There's satellite measurements. And the other is with thousands, hundreds of thousands of individual stations around the Earth that just simply keep track of temperatures, and then they put all that data into a computer and crunch it and come out with numbers. And then they also measure sea temperatures that way. And what they found is that over the last 30 years or so, the Earth has warmed by about 6/10 of a degree, and it might even be 8/10 of a degree. It's either 0.6 or 0.8 of a degree Celsius, of 1 degree Celsius, a little more than 1 degree Fahrenheit. And what this means, what this warming means, is that, you know, heat is basically energy. When the atmosphere heats up, the motion, it's called Brownian motion, the kind of random normal motion of the molecules that make up air, all the different components of air, including water vapor, that motion increases. And the energy that's in the atmosphere increases. Heat is simply a form of energy. And it's a form of energy that provokes other things. It provokes motion in the atmosphere. And it also means that the atmosphere, because it is warmer, can hold more moisture. And we know, the other thing we know is that there's about 5% more water vapor in the atmosphere right now, more moisture than there was 30 years ago as a result of this heating. And that's why our storms, our super soakers, compared to 30 years ago, more commonly our storms are far worse, in part because there's more water in the atmosphere to come out when hot air hits cold air, and in part because there's more energy in the atmosphere to create the disturbances, the violent disturbances. And this is why the typhoons are getting more violent. It's why the hurricanes are getting more violent. It's why for the first time in ever we're seeing mile-wide tornadoes in the Midwest. All of these things are the early leading indicators. And they used to think that we really didn't need to worry until we hit 3 or 4 degrees Celsius, you know, 5-6 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, modern science, I mean, just in the last decade, they're saying, you know, if we hit 2 degrees, it's going to be a major disaster. And if we hit 4 degrees, we could be looking at an extinction event that could kill everything. So if you go over to lasthours.org, you'll see more information on this. Levan, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
That's lasthours.org. It's the first video that we did, and we've got another one coming out in the next few weeks as a follow-up. Welcome back. And John in Highbridge, New Jersey. Hey, John, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. You wanted to talk about jury nullification?
That's what it's called. Yeah, I'm actually reading Michelle Alexander's book on the new Jim Crow, and my wife had been called for jury duty, and I wanted to explain to her that even if you think the person is guilty of the crime they're charged, there's a process by which you cannot vote. I just was hoping you could explain that again.
Sure.
I'll take the answer off the air just that
no,
I
can. No, it's fine. Stick around, John, because you may have a follow-up question. There's a catch-22 wrapped in here. The way that the law, or the way that the doctrine, I guess, has been interpreted over the years is that as a member of a jury, you are basically the highest court in the land for the case that's in front of you. You have Supreme Court's powers. It's kind of like in Judaism, you know, Sabbath is the holiest holiday, and it happens every single week. Local courts are the ultimate authority. So as a juror, you have the ability not only to determine whether the person is guilty or innocent of the crime, but you also have the power to determine whether you believe that the law under which they are being prosecuted is a just law or even a constitutional law. And you can choose to ignore the law, or you can choose to ignore the person's guilt or innocence. Now, here's the catch-22. When you are sworn in for jury duty, the judge, in most cases, will ask, will you swear an oath, raise your hand and swear an oath, that you will decide this case based on the law? In other words, you will waive your right to determine whether or not the law is just. You will waive your right to jury nullification. And typically people don't even know about their right to jury nullification. But if they do, at that point, if you say, yes, I will render a judgment in this case according to the law before us, then you go into the jury room and you say, hey, we're going to do jury nullification, blow this law up. You've just committed perjury, basically. You've just lied under oath. Now, I don't think that they can prosecute you, because I think that juries are basically immune from prosecution for things other than fraud. You know, if he says, are you related to the criminal, and you say no, and it turns out you are, you can actually, there's some serious prosecution for that kind of stuff. I don't know of anybody being prosecuted for exercising the right of jury nullification, but it is a ethical, if not legal, conundrum, because in order to get on a jury, you have to give up your right, at least 50% of your rights as a juror, under the current system. And I think that the reason why that has become customary in juries, you know, because if they say, do you swear you will, you know, do this under the law, and you say, maybe, maybe not, I want to know what the law is, as a juror, I have the right to determine if that law is just, at that point the judge will say, okay, you're discharged, you're not going to serve on a jury. And then you don't get to be on the jury. And this is not a good way to get out of jury duty, and I'm not advertising it as such. But do you see the kind of catch 22 here?
So if you even said that you were aware of the jury nullification, that would almost be a disqualification in and of itself.
Every case that I've ever heard of, you get, not only do you get automatically disqualified, but anybody who's in the room with you who heard you talking about it will get disqualified.
Gee whiz.
Yeah. So, you know, it's like, this is like grabbing high tension wires, you know, it's tread carefully here. John, thanks a lot for the call. I would suggest that you spend a little bit of time on the internet researching the subject. It's called jury nullification. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 10 minutes before the hour, and Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Hey, Victoria, I see you're in the White House today.
I'm in the basement.
Indeed, in the luxury Talk Radio News suite, a.k.a. broom closet. It looks like great fun. So what's going on there?
Well, we're just having the briefing with White House spokesman Josh Earnest, who's waxing on any number of topics, including immigration and the crisis at the Texas border.
So it sounds like today he was more earnest than Josh.
He was more earnest than Josh, I would say, today. Although, I'll start with that story then. I'll start with my Josh story.
Okay.
I'll jump. Get it out of the way, because otherwise I might not even get to it, because you know how these things go. With my Josh story, he was asked who, in fact, is the president going to support in the World Cup final on Sunday, Argentina or Germany? He was asked by Reuters, I think it was. And perhaps it should be Germany, Reuters said with a large wink.
Oh, because we're having some diplomatic problems with them right now, and maybe he could curry some favor?
Yeah. And Josh appreciated the way that the question was asked, but didn't rise to the bait.
Uh-huh.
Said that he didn't know, and he wasn't sure if he'd get a chance to watch it, but he hadn't talked to him about who he was supporting in that final. Meantime, on the other side of the pond, a game of two popes, there seems to be no truth to the rumor that Pope Francis and his predecessor, Pope Benedict, will be watching the game together. Pope Benedict, who's German, is apparently not a soccer fan, and it's maybe after his bedtime. time. But Pope Francis, who's from Argentina, is a rabid soccer fan.
Right. My understanding is that these two popes also are not like best buds.
They're not buds. They don't hang.
Yeah.
They don't hang.
Yeah.
They don't exchange robe stories.
Yeah, there you go.
Benedict hangs out with his cats.
Oh, really?
He's a huge cat man.
Oh, interesting.
That is his redeeming feature.
I would agree.
Yes. Yes. So I think Pope Francis will be watching, but Pope Francis has actually called for a pause for peace before the game.
Wow. Worldwide, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pause for peace. Oh, so wow. Having got that story out of the way, that's like my good news story of the day. On we go. House Republican Appropriations Committee Chairman Hal Rogers said today that President Obama's emergency funding request of $3.7 billion is, quote, too much. Number one, it's too much money. We don't need it. Secondly, a lot of what he's requesting is being considered in the regular bill process. This for the crisis at the Texas border with the undocumented children, and in some cases their mothers, coming over. Josh Earnest was asked about this today, and he said that what was important was that Congress moves quickly. He also said he'd like to see Republicans back up their rhetoric with urgent action. He also said he was open to conversation, that President Obama was open to conversations if Republicans have suggestions. But again, he wants to see action and quickly.
Right.
On that.
Good luck on that. I mean, there is going to be some action. John Boehner's going to sue him is going to sue President Obama for enforcing Obamacare for not implementing Obamacare fast enough, which is bizarre.
Right. He's going to sue him over the employer mandate. Earnest was also asked about that, did not have a response, continued to call it a political taxpayer-funded stunt.
Which it is.
And that is very much the White House view of this. No response so far on a legal front to it,
yeah.
Boehner's lawsuit.
Well, do we even know what court Boehner intends to file this in?
It's going to be in a federal court, is my understanding.
So the federal court, the District of Columbia?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know where it'll be. I don't know exactly.
Because I'd wonder how he's going to find standing someplace.
Well, one of the big questions is whether he's going to have standing, whether he will have standing, or in fact, you know, also whether a judge is going to touch it. Some judges might turn around and say, you know, you too, go back and sort it out in the sandbox.
Right, exactly. The way that I used to talk to my kids.
Yeah, so it's
so you guys are going to fight, go do it in the other room.
Yeah. Really unclear.
Yeah. I could see if Boehner has some employers who actually wanted to be able to buy Obamacare on the exchange. I'm one of them, although I wouldn't join a lawsuit against the president. But if he has some small employers who wanted to be able to buy Obamacare, they could advance a lawsuit against the president.
Because they've been harmed.
Right. Exactly. I think I would have standing for that. For example, because my insurance rates went up so much this year as an employer. But, you know, that's not going to help John Boehner any. I mean, that's a whole separate thing. That's sort of like the Hobby Lobby thing. You know, that just becomes another case.
Well, I think it's going to be a very interesting challenge. I do think it was smart not to go with the deportation issue with the Dreamers.
Right.
I don't think he stood any chance with that. I think he stands a fraction more.
Well, and that would have hurt the Republican Party with Hispanics terribly.
Exactly, exactly. At least Obamacare's unpopular.
Yeah.
Relatively.
Relatively, yeah.
Relatively. On Israel, a fourth day of Israeli airstrikes on the Gaza Strip killed 11 more Palestinians today, at least the last time anybody gave numbers, up to 96 Palestinians killed, many of them civilians, including at least 23 children. Yesterday, President Obama told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu he's willing to help negotiate a ceasefire. Also today, there were at least two, possibly three rockets lobbed over the northern border into Israel from Lebanon. It's unclear who sent the rockets at this point. Nobody looks interested in having a ceasefire brokered by the United States at this point either.
That's unfortunate. We need Jimmy Carter. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Victoria, thank you.
Thank you.
Have a great evening.
You too.
And a great weekend. We'll be back with more of Anything Goes Friday right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I keep trying to get back over to the New York Times to read this piece by Paul Krugman, Who Wants a Depression? I keep getting busy during the breaks, and I have not had an opportunity to read it. But I can tell you who wants a depression, and all you have to do is look at their behavior, the Republicans. They would love it if there was a 1929 kind of event, and they're doing everything they can to make it happen. Killing demand in our economy to try and make the economy really suck, because they would love it if a Democrat went down in history as the Herbert Hoover of the 21st century. Herbert Hoover famously was the, you know, had the misfortune in 1929 of being just a few months into his presidency. You know what, 8 months, 9 months into his presidency. Back then they swore people into office in March, and in October, 7 months, yeah, in October, the stock market melted down. And here's this new president going, whoa, what do I do with this? And for the next 3 years, he basically said, he tried a few things, you know, but didn't do much and it didn't help. And so FDR came in and ate his lunch and reformed America. I mean, really, it was a genuine revolution. And up until the Reagan Revolution, we had been living under the Roosevelt Revolution, which brought peace and prosperity across the land. And then Lyndon Johnson took the Roosevelt Revolution and expanded it with the Great Society. And then Reagan came along and said, okay, enough of that. We're going to reverse all this stuff. And systematically began, you know, Roosevelt and Johnson have been strengthening our schools, strengthening our public institutions, strengthening the social safety net, helping people to have bootstraps, to pull them up by their bootstraps, helping people move out of poverty into the middle class. And Reagan said, we're going to do the opposite of all that. We're going to take all these trillions, all this wealth, all this money, and we're going to give it to the billionaires, the people who put me in office, or him in office. So anyway, I think my rhetorical answer to Paul Krugman's rhetorical question, who wants a depression, is the Republicans. And they would love it if it happens in the next year or two, so that and then they will be able to prevent President Obama from doing anything about it, because he would have to have Congress to go along with it. They're not going to pass another stimulus. They're not going to do anything to get us out of a depression. And then Obama would go down in history as Herbert Hoover. And the Republicans would win everything in the election of 2016. And, you know, they would have their way with us, as they say. Okay, somebody called a little earlier, and it's Anything Goes Friday. I'm going to get right to your calls here in just a second. But somebody called earlier and asked me about jury nullification. And I pointed out that there is this odd catch-22. jury nullification is the doctrine which has been part of the common law of the United States and, frankly, of England before the United States, that the highest court in the land is actually the local jury. And that you as a juror have the ability not only to decide guilt or innocence of a person based on the law, but you also have the right to decide whether you believe that this law applies to this case or not, or even if this law, well, the effect would be whether this law applies to this case. If you disagree with the law, you can simply say, you know, I'm not going to enforce this law for whatever reason. I don't like it. I think it's unconstitutional. It's against my religion, whatever. And that's called jury nullification. It's where the jury can nullify a guilty verdict or nullify a law, in effect. And I said that the catch-22 to this is that when you're sworn in as a juror across the United States, the judge will ask you to raise your hand and take an oath saying that, you know, I swear that I will judge this case as a juror based on the facts presented before me in the context of the law as it is explained to me by the judge in the jury instructions. Well, in doing that, if you say yes, you've waived your right to jury nullification, basically. You've given up half your rights as a juror. Half of it is to judge the person. The other half is to judge the case, the law. And if you say, no, I want to retain my right to jury nullification, the judge will not only kick you out of the courtroom, but he'll kick out anybody who heard you say that. Because in most states in the United States, defense attorneys are not allowed to say this to juries. If you guys don't like this law, Trayvon Martin case, they could have, you know, under jury nullification, the defense attorney could have said, well, actually the prosecutor in the Trayvon Martin case could have said to the jury, and, you know, if you don't like the defense that George Zimmerman is making, that he, under the Stand Your Ground law, he had the right to kill an unarmed kid, you can simply nullify that law. You can ignore the law and just find him guilty of murder or manslaughter. But see, in Florida, if you do that, the judge, as your boss, you're an officer of the court and you're operating under the judge will, you know, there can be some fairly stiff penalties, shall we say. There's one exception to this, and that's the state of New Hampshire. In the year 2012, year before last, went into effect, I think this year, 2013. Thank you. Went into effect 2013. The New Hampshire legislature passed H. Bill 146, which says, this is an act relative, and it was signed by the governor, an act relative to the right of a jury to judge the application of the law in relation to the facts in controversy. It's the title of it. In the year of our Lord, 2012, and literally says that at the top of the page, the amended analysis, this bill states that in all criminal proceedings, the court shall permit the defense to inform the jury of its right to judge the facts and the application of the law in relationship to the facts in controversy. So the court will permit defense attorneys to inform juries of their right to jury nullification. In fact, here's the actual language, 243.1, findings and intent of the general court. Under the decisions of both the New Hampshire Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court, the jury has the right to judge the facts and the application of the law in relationship to the facts in controversy. The jury system functions at its best when it is fully informed of the jury's prerogatives. The general court wishes to perpetuate and reiterate the rights of the jury as ordained under common law and recognized in American jurisprudence while preserving the rights of a criminal defendant as enumerated in Part 1, Articles 15 and 20 of the New Hampshire Bill of Rights. In all criminal proceedings, the court shall permit the defense to inform the jury of its right to judge the facts and the application of the law in relation to the facts in controversy. This act shall take effect January 1st, 2013. Signed in the year of our Lord, 2012, 9-5, September 5th. Very interesting. Anyhow, anything goes Friday. Morris in Long Beach, California, listening on KPFK. Uh-oh.
Professor.
Morris, you're on the air.
Shouldn't Mr. Netanyahu be concerned about a pushback should he invade Palestine?
I think so, big time. I think that's probably one of the things that's preventing him from going into Gaza is that he would be viewed very poorly by the international courts. And Morris, thank you for the call. And this would be a major problem. Morris, I need you to hang up on your end because I can't hang up on my end. My call screening software has just gone nuts. I'm going to reboot it right now. Danielle, you don't need to do anything. I'm just assuming it's on my end, and I'm just going to try to restart it. Oh, we're hitting a break now anyway. Okay. We'll be right back, and Jim will drop a fill-in here for a couple minutes while we figure all this out. We'll be back. Anything goes wrong.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday in just a moment. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. There was a disturbance in the force. Indeed. Howard in Coriopolis, Pennsylvania, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. Hey, Howard, what's up?
Tom, I don't have any facts to back this up. I guess at Fox News, can you say that they're fair and balanced? I can make my attempt, but I want to give you a scenario. Whereas I am suspicious that these offshore bank accounts, like the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, and Switzerland, that a judge can be bought and they can park money in an offshore bank account in his name. Now, as I say, I can't back that up, but when you don't have any transparency in these offshore bank accounts, who knows what's going on?
Yeah, I don't disagree, and I think that I think that that's we've got a really screwed up system. It's like our banks have so much power, so much political power because of the money that they represent and because of their ability to devastate world economies. I mean, look at what happened in 2007, 2008. The banks have so much power that they're basically calling the tune, and it's not a good thing. Howard, thank you for pointing that out. It's a good one. Rebecca in Lyle, Washington. Hey, Rebecca. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. What's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I was wondering if you realize that some of us whom you call ugly because we don't want to see illegal immigration continue apace, that we're concerned about the overpopulation of this country. I've been around long enough to see the loss in wildlife habitat, farmland, how about highway gridlock, to see all the things that overpopulation bring. And, you know, overpopulation isn't just out there. It's coming here. At some point, we have to decide how big we want the population of America to be. Do we want 500 million? We can have it. Because, you know, there are a whole lot of people who want to come here.
Sure.
When do we decide what our population should be? And when do we decide it's time for a moratorium on immigration? And in this case, as I understand it, these children are being sent here to escape poverty and violence, which I can understand. But you know what? We've got poverty and violence for some children in our own country. How about the inner cities?
Yeah.
What do we do for those children?
Rebecca, you make a good point. And I have not, and in fact, you'll read an entire chapter about this in my book, Rebooting the American Dream, that in my opinion, the one of the big sins of the Reagan administration was he stopped enforcing the law that put employers in jail if they hired people who are not citizens. That's the only reason why 11 million people have come to this country without documentation, is because they could get jobs. And before Reagan, they couldn't get jobs. And so they didn't come. I mean, you know, people would come to the Central Valley before the picking season, and they'd leave after the picking season. But, you know, Reagan changed everything. But that is distinct from in my opinion, I think that we should be enforcing those laws against the employers and make meatpacking once again, you know, a good union and job, and construction once again a good union job. But that said, and we have to have some kind of immigration reform, but that said, what's happening right now is, in my opinion, a refugee crisis, not an immigration crisis. And we're not talking about enough people to overcrowd our country, 50,000 kids. Welcome back. 10 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Greg in Jackson Springs, North Carolina. Hey, Greg, you wanted to talk about the GOP and taxes?
Yes, Tom, changing the subject a little bit, but it's Open Friday.
Yeah.
I've been thinking for the last couple of months of trying to formulate an argument to the wealthy and to the Republicans about what they perceive to be the unfairness in taxes in this country, where they believe the wealthy pay too much towards the taxes and the rest of us don't pay enough. And my answer to that is, to some degree, cynically, yes, I agree with you. But the reason that it's this way is because the pay of the rest of us is so low. And if you really want us to pay more taxes, simply raise our pay.
Well, and in fact, if you look at the history of this country, what you find is that the times that government revenues increased the most were times of increasing unionization, increasing wages, and an increasing middle class. That raises government revenues dramatically more than raising the top tax rate. You raise the top tax rate to produce a social and economic good. It stabilizes the economy, it stops hot money, it stops speculation, and it reduces inequality in society. That's a distinct thing from, that's a different thing from saying we do it to fund the government. You want to fund the government, strengthen the middle class, because the middle class pays all kinds of 16 ways to Sunday they pay taxes.
And that's that. You're absolutely right. I agree with you. Why should we be in favor of unions? Because they make more money and therefore they pay more taxes.
Right. Yep.
We as Democrats are not getting this message out there.
Yeah.
I think so much of where we miss the boat is in the in how we phrase and send messages to the public. Because I hate to say this, but a few of my friends are as deep into this thought as I am, or any political thought.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the public is disengaged, and I understand why they are, because this all can be extremely frustrating. And so they listen to the catchphrases, the wealthy pay X percentage of the taxes and they're only X percentage of the income. Well, that may be right, but there's a reason why we have to have them pay this. And
yeah.
I just wish that we could somehow get to our leaders of the Democratic Party and get them to talking.
I think, Greg, it goes beyond that. What you're talking about is civics, is basic economics. This is the stuff that needs to be taught in fourth, fifth, and sixth grades.
Not being taught anymore, though.
It is not. It is not. But it was, you know, at least in Michigan, it was being taught when I was growing up, when I was in elementary school in the 50s and in junior high school and high school in the 60s. It was taught.
We're the same age, and I agree. I grew up in Northern Virginia.
Yeah.
But it's not being taught anymore.
Yeah, we learned those things, but people don't learn it anymore. They don't learn civics. They don't learn economics, both macro and micro. In fact, they don't even know the difference between the two. And by the time I graduated sixth grade, I did. And I'm guessing you did too, Greg. And, you know, not to sound like two old farts sitting around going, the kids these days, I remember back in the... But the reality is that a relentless 34-year war on public education that started when Ronald Reagan put William Bennett in charge of the Education Department in 1981, William Bennett, who ran for president on the platform of abolishing the Education Department, this relentless war against public education that's been going on for 34 years here under Reaganomics, has borne fruit. And to some extent, it's borne fruit in this the dumbing down of America. It's tragic. Greg, thank you for the call. Excellent and important point. Mike in Fairfax, Virginia. Hey, Mike, what's up?
How are you doing, Tom? I had 2 points. I wanted to compliment you for something you said earlier in the show and help you focus the millennial anger on something you said yesterday.
So the compliment is, I was glad to hear you say you don't like eugenics and racism, and you thought it was racism, and you thought it was a despicable practice. Maybe someday you could educate your progressive friends on Margaret Sanger, the patriarch or the matriarch of Planned Parenthood, and her views on, I think she called them the mentally feeble people that she wanted eradicated,
yeah.
And why she set up her clinics where she did, and what she wrote in some of her essays about different minorities in America.
That was in the 20s?
You talked about eugenics in America in the 1920s, which was right at the heyday of Margaret Sanger, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was, and you're right. But similarly, the Democratic Party used to be the party of the KKK. That's not how it is today. And so, Mike, we can go back into history all you want. The way it is today is that the party of racism and race baiting is the Republican Party, and the party of let's work together and make these things happen and let's get along, and the party of women's rights is the Democratic Party. It's that simple.
Yeah. So the thing I wanted to help you focus, the anger of the millennials, you said they're getting ready to inherit $30 trillion, but they are furious at the banksters for screwing them with student loans. Have you ever heard of...
Well, it's not just student loans. They watched what happened in 2008. I mean, you know, look at the Occupy movement. It was about Occupy Wall Street. It wasn't Occupy McDonald's. It was Occupy Wall Street.
Have you heard of the Health Care and Education Reconciliation Act, which is the sister act to the Affordable Care Act?
No, I have not.
It went into effect July 1st, 2010, and basically the federal government took over all student loans. So the day before that went into effect, there was $178 billion in student loans. Now we have over $700 billion, rapidly approaching a trillion.
Right.
So that's an increase of 277% with the federal government running it over the banks.
Yeah, and the federal government is showing a profit of some $60 billion a year on
Correct.
Student loans.
So,
and this is a bad thing, Mike. Are you willing to say, as a conservative, are you willing to say that we should go back to doing what FDR did, or what Harry Truman did, and just give free education to everybody?
No, I'm not.
Okay. Well, see, that's where I would go on this. I think that there needs to be a debt jubilee. We're talking $1 trillion. If we can spend $3 trillion in Iraq and Afghanistan, we can spend $1 trillion on the intellectual infrastructure of this country. We could nullify the debt of everybody in this country who has a student loan. Simply say, that's it, no more. Or we could work out a way that they get, you know, banks can get loans from the Fed at less than 1%. Why can't students? Right? We could do one or the other.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Or we could even do both. I mean, there's a lot of things that could be done about this. None of them will be done because they all require congressional action. And guess who's in charge of Congress? Yeah, that's right, the Republicans. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from Washington, D.C. And Mark in Charleston, West Virginia. Hey, Mark. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I've always had a problem with what occurred the night of the Obama inaugural, from a general, you know, loyalty to the United States in general. But it just occurred to me from listening to the show today, I always thought that sedition and treason were context in terms of war and not applicable to that situation. But if we were under emergency powers and these Republicans met and decided he wasn't to succeed at anything, doesn't that give rise to the possibility of articles of impeachment for those that did that and made that pledge to something other than the United States Constitution or the United States?
Well, just
that result in their arrest?
Yeah. First of all, for people who don't know what you're talking about, the night that Obama was first inaugurated on January 20th, 2009, for his first inaugural, that day, you know, 3 million people showed up here in D.C. and he was inaugurated. I was standing 60 feet from him when it happened, doing my show live, this show. And then that night he was going around dancing at the balls. Ellen Ratner and I went to the one here in Union Station. And while we were dancing with Joe Biden and his wife and Barack and Michelle Obama over at the Caucus Room restaurant, which is over at the corner of D and 9th Northwest, about a mile away, these 13, 14 members of Congress had gotten together, the leadership basically of the House and the Senate, and on the Republican side, along with Frank Luntz and Newt Gingrich, and Newt has come on this program and bragged about this, they got together and they basically hatched what is referred to as the caucus room conspiracy, where they decided that they would absolutely fight Obama on everything, that this man was going to have no legacy when he left office. He was going to have no successes. He was going to be a failed president. And because and they knew that they could get away with this because the majority of Americans are so poorly informed about the news, because we have infotainment now instead of news, that more than 60%, in fact, more than 70% by some studies of Americans can't tell you which party controls which branch of Congress. So they knew that if they could screw the country up and prevent Obama from doing any good, that he would be the one blamed for it. And so that's what we're talking about here. And you're pointing out that George Bush, in, on September 14th of 2001, declared a national state of emergency, and that it has been renewed every year since then, including last year it was renewed. We are still operating under a state of emergency. It was renewed by President Obama. And therefore is a conspiracy to obstruct the normal and appropriate and proper functioning of government construable as either an impeachable offense for a member of Congress or as a crime, as sedition. And impeachment has to originate in the House of Representatives. They're not going to impeach themselves. And the Republicans control the House of Representatives, so there's no way they're even going to investigate themselves or take it to an ethics panel. Although I think that the Democrats in the Senate should be making a lot of noise around this, and I wish Harry Reid would do so. I'm not holding out a lot of hope, but because, you know, hey, it's politicians getting together deciding to take down a politician. That's sort of, as Newt Gingrich said on this program, he said, we're the opposition party. It's our job to oppose. Now, the founders would have disagreed with that vehemently, but that's the way politics is played right now. But I think that you could make a case for at least a people's court, a people's prosecution of some kind, or maybe in some venue, I don't know where you would get standing, to say that the obstruction that these guys have done, particularly the ones who bragged about it, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensling, the ones who bragged about it in the public media, and the ones who have orchestrated it, Tom Coburn, you know, basically. I'm pretty sure Coburn was there. Let me pull out my list here. Yeah, Coburn was there. And, you know, Dr. No, he's, you know, filibustered pretty much all the legislation that's been brought to the Senate. Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Corker were the members of the Senate. And then the members of the House were Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren. And that these guys were guilty of something during time of war or something during times of national emergency. I'm not sure what, Mark. Maybe somebody who's an attorney or who understands the politics of law could call in and share something on that. Thanks a lot for the call. Richard in Victorville, California. Hey, Richard, you wanted to talk about Bill Keller?
Yeah, yesterday I was trying to get in while you had this guy on the radio. And, you know, it kills me how all of these evangelists sit here and quote the Bible, but then the majority of these people who carry Bibles don't really know the history of their religion other than what they're taught in the Bible itself. They don't understand the actual boots-on-the-ground history of how all this stuff came about.
Yeah.
And, you know, you were talking about the church, you know, like the Pauline church as opposed to the Church of Peter, which was actually new information to me, and I appreciate that. But, you know, it's funny because, you know, the Catholic Church and Christianity, you know, back in the third century, when the New Testament was actually put together, you know, they were battling for power as a young religion in this world, you know, against a bunch of other things, and they were so fragmented that it took a Roman general to bring the church together.
Well, and in fact, the Roman Empire was starting to decay, and they made a deal with the Christians and said, you endorse us, we'll endorse you. We'll stop killing Christians. You start, you know, being Romans. And that created that kind of reincarnated the Roman Empire. And I got to tell you, when Pope John Paul II invited Louise and I to come to Castle Gandolfo, his summer palace up on this caldera, this volcanic mountain lake, back in 99, I think it was. And I was sitting there just you know, 30 feet from the Pope listening to this concert. And then afterwards, we had a private audience with him. And he's sitting in this giant throne, this giant gold throne. And behind him is a 9-foot-tall statue of Peter with the keys to the kingdom of God in one hand and a book in the other hand. And it's, and I'm looking at the Swiss guard and, you know, all the, you know, this guy's a head of state, right? The Vatican is a state in the United Nations. And it suddenly hit me. This guy, you know, he controls 1 billion Catholics worldwide. He could start a world war simply by just saying, you know, kill all the Jews or kill all the Muslims. You know, the Pope has mind-boggling power. But what really hit me was looking at that statue of Peter. Peter had been Romanified or whatever. He looked like the classic Roman god, you know, almost a Greek god statue, as opposed to a Semitic Middle Eastern Jew, which is what Peter was. And it hit me that the Catholic Church is simply the perpetuation of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire is still alive and well. It calls itself the Catholic Church.
Well, yeah, and I mean, you know, I will give Constantine credit for understanding, you know, the society of his day, and by bringing the church into, you know, into his control, you know, at the Council of Nicaea and unify with them, you know, isn't it much easier to conquer the world if you take the people's hearts and souls instead of having to crucify their bodies?
Yep. Yep, absolutely. I mean, you could say the Ottoman Empire did the same thing in the name of Islam.
Ecology of how to win without having to fire a shot.
Yeah, yeah. I don't disagree. And, yeah, I guess the good news about the modern-day Roman Empire, a.k.a. the Catholic Church, is that the leaders of it have gotten progressively more enlightened, and now, you know, Pope Francis gives me great hope. I mean, I've got a picture of him over my shoulder here going, hi! Because I think he's just a cool guy. We'll see where this all goes. But, Richard, thank you for the call. Excellent point. Christine in Fort Collins, Colorado. Hey, Christine, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I want to just mention two quick things. First of all, as far as the peace movement that is attempting to take place within Israel itself, people should go to there's a Facebook page called Israel Loves Iran, and that was started during the whole try to, you know, trumping up the war drums for Israel to invade Iran and stuff.
Right.
And this guy started this Facebook page, and it's just very, very heartwarming. Then Iranians did their own counter one, Iran Loves Israel, and it's very heartwarming, and it breaks your heart. The guy is just, who started it, is just a wonderful man who's trying his best to facilitate peace, and he realizes that violence just perpetuates more violence.
Yep.
But the reason for my call, the woman who had called earlier, who was upset with how you were portraying Israel, she used a phrase that has become almost urban legend, and I've heard Hillary Clinton use it. I've heard so many people use it. It's that phrase, wipe Israel off the map,
right,
that was said supposedly by Ahmadinejad, and this is in no way, in shape, or form.
Yeah. Hey, Ahmadinejad never said that.
It was a mistranslation,
yes,
of what was said.
But here's the problem, Christine. Hamas does not officially, they will not recognize the legitimacy of Israel to exist as a state, as a nation.
No. I understand that.
And they've got to give a little. I mean, you know, what's his name over in the Western occupied territories, the West Bank, actually said, okay, we recognize you.
No, I understand that. It's just that phrase has become urban legend. And
yeah.
Juan Cole over at Informed Comment challenges that, and he knows farce. And that's all. She had just used that phrase. But no, I understand that.
I'm with you, Christine. Thank you for the call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And earlier in the show, we'd had Nancy Skinner on. Some folks have contacted us and said, where do I reach that? It's Skinner for Congress, forcongress.com. And welcome back. Hang on just a second. I can't do that. Ron in Redoso, New Mexico, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Do I have that right, Ron?
You do.
Wow. I pulled it off. So you want to talk about Citizens United?
I had called yesterday, but I didn't get in under the wire when you and Bernie were talking about Citizens United. In the exercise of full disclosure, I'm an old-time plaintiff's lawyer representing, or, you know, I used to represent the down and depressed. And now, in further in the exercise of full disclosure, I'm a member of the 0.01% club, right?
Okay.
But I'm the reason I called is that I think there may be a way to deal with Citizens United, and I don't have a forum. You know, I'm old and tired, and you know, I'm you know, I take a great interest in politics, but I don't have the forum that you do, and so. And so the point of the call is I just wanted to plant a seed in your mind.
Go for it.
To see if you have any interest in it or, you know, it has any merit. And if it doesn't, well, then it doesn't.
Yeah, we've got about 2 minutes or a minute and a half here, Ron.
Okay.
Lay it out.
All right, here it is. All of the time I hear Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, Harry Reid on TV saying, well, there's only one way to get around Citizens United, and that is a constitutional amendment, and that's not going to happen. There's no chance of that happening. I submit to you that there is another way around it. And you and your cohorts and Move On, you know, could do this if they wanted to, and here's the way you would get around it. Or maybe not fully, but at least hamstring it. And the way you do it is to go to the FCC with a petition. Most of the people on that, the FCC, were appointed by Obama.
The Federal Communications Commission.
Yes.
Okay.
And the way you do it is this. You say, okay, guys, okay, Koch brothers, here's the deal. You can use all your all the dark money that you have in the world to buy all of the soapboxes behind all of the grocery stores in the entire United States and place them on every corner, street corner, and courthouse square. You can, you know, all right. that you want to do.
But you can't go on television. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, you can do it on the Internet.
But,
but you know, you can't. We own the airways.
Right.
We own the public airways.
Ron, that would be before the Supreme Court in a New York minute, and they would strike it down.
I don't think you're right about that, because George Carlin, you remember George Carlin?
I remember George Carlin
words,
well. Yeah.
Seven dirty words.
Yeah.
You remember Janet Jackson, you know,
the
malfunction?
Yep.
The FCC has an immense amount of control over what goes through the...
With regard to obscenity. But the First Amendment, the Supreme Court has interpreted the First Amendment repeatedly to be extremely broad when it comes to politics, even if they're going to narrow when it comes to obscenity.
Well, you're wrong about that. All you have to do is read the Citizens United decision.
I've read it.
You carefully read the Citizens United decision, you will see that they extol the virtues in that decision.
Okay. Ron, we're out of time, but thank you for the call and thank you for the suggestion. We'll be right back. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmaster, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, all the folks at the various companies that syndicate this program, from Westwood One to Pacifica Radio to SiriusXM Satellite Radio, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV, On Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, from Comcast to Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, to all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to Netroots Radio at netrootsradio.com, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in the chat room, to Alan Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, and to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. You make this program, and it is very, very, very much appreciated. Matt in Trent, New Jersey. Hey, Matt. Thanks thanks for listening to Sirius. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, hi. I've got a question for you. Do you know what the status is of the JFK movie with Leonardo DiCaprio?
Warner Brothers was going to make the movie last year. This is a classical Hollywood tale, right? Warner Brothers was going to make the movie. It was announced. It was funded. Lamar and I got, option checks. The screenplay was given to a fairly famous screenwriter who I don't want to name, and he basically blew it. And so it went back to the drawing board. It went back to the drawing board twice, in fact. And because they were telling the true story of a guy who's still alive, he wanted to have some say in this. And it just got all tangled up, and Warner Brothers ended up dropping it. And so right now, the latest I've heard is that Leonardo and Robert De Niro still want to make this movie. The production company still owns the movie, still owns the option and the rights, and they are shopping it around right now to other houses. So right now it's up in the air.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm sorry. We were hoping to get the thing out in time for the 50th anniversary, but it didn't happen. So
earlier in the week, you had Robert Perry on.
Yeah.
And he was suggesting that the Watergate burglars were looking for the evidence of Nixon's treason.
Yes.
And then you and Lamar were suggesting that the burglars were looking for what, the Castro dossier. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, it's hard to say. It might have been all of the above.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it probably is all of the above. Matt, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, Lamar's new book on Watergate is mind-boggling. Greg in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Hey, how are you? Hey, Tom. I know it's not a lot of time. I called in, I think, a couple weeks ago, and I was talking about the kids being diagnosed with ADD, categorizing together with the standardized test. What I wanted to say, and I kind of got around to sort of only in the beginning, is that there is a way to reform schools, but I don't think it'll ever happen in this country, at least not in public schools, because they're mostly used as daycare centers when two parents are working. But if the schools actually cared about educating the kids and getting better equipped citizens, I think what they should do at this point is replace textbooks with give every parent an iPad, parent-controlled tablet, right? Have a marketplace where they can deliver the lectures at home, but have the kids come in and flip the classroom where people actually, the kids get tested in the beginning of the day. And each day they can actually measure where some of the kids are being left behind. And those kids can have smaller remedial classes.
Yeah.
And so it would actually
Here's the problem with that, Greg. Number one, when you interact with something electronic, you have different parts of your brain are involved than when you interact with something physical. And it's a different kind of learning. These MOOCs, massive online groups, online classrooms, where universities are saying, yes, you can attend this class and this class, and people can actually go to school online, and a professor can teach a million people at once. They've failed. They fail spectacularly. Online instruction is very, very difficult to make work. And I think that books are really important, and number one. And number two, I think that the two most important things that people get out of school, or at least that I got out of school, were social interactions with others, learning how to function in a social environment, and learning how to challenge, how to develop critical thinking skills, how to challenge conventional wisdom, how to understand things, learning how to think, learning how to learn. And neither of those happen in a testing environment. Testing simply measures memorization. And memorization is the least important, in my opinion, of the skills that we acquire in school, particularly going forward as all the knowledge in the world is available on your iPad. Memorization becomes virtually irrelevant. Although it's still useful to be able to have things at the tip of your fingers. Respectfully, I would disagree.
No, sure. I just want to make it clear. I'm not saying just have MOOCs. Have no social interaction in school. What I'm saying is there's studies that show that when you deliver a lecture at a student's own pace, if they go to the bathroom, if they want to rewind, they can do that. But if the interaction has to happen in group environments, that's when you actually can, after the test, you can actually practice things. There are certain subjects which are not just, they don't lend themselves to just memorization. You actually have to practice these things.
Right.
But having a boring lecture for the kids, they're told to sit down and shut up for 8 hours a day. that causes a lot of the ADD diagnoses, is what
I agree with that, and I think that's one of the reasons why schools are getting more interactive and more Socratic. Our teachers are adapting. However, they're getting more and more neurologically challenged kids, which I think is an environmental crisis, frankly, and probably a food supply crisis, but certainly a packaged foods, processed foods crisis. And now this new study out about the GMO products is downright scary. It's talking about liver and kidney, but who knows what's happening to the brain. Greg, thanks a lot for the call. It's a thought-provoking topic, and there's a lot of work that needs to be done. We need to be prioritizing education, though. It's part of our infrastructure. It's our intellectual infrastructure. It's arguably our most important infrastructure. And instead, we are increasingly saying, oh, let's privatize it. Let's figure out some way that some rich guy can make a buck off it. That's the wrong way to go. It's just the wrong way. So anyhow, it's been a great week. I hope you've had a great week and you have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. Thanks so much for being with us. And don't forget, democracy it's not a spectator sport. It begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.